Hello, and welcome to Comfortably Unnumb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson. I am the host of this podcast, and I'm also the program's manager here at the Umbrella Society in beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territory of the Lekwungen-speaking people. And season three of Comfortably Unnumb is off to the races. 2 weeks ago, we had on Daryl, who shared his story. What an absolute character and great way to start off this season. I'm absolutely thrilled that I get to continue this podcast, that there's an audience and that people are getting inspired by the stories these amazing individuals are sharing about their recovery and about their challenges and their addiction. For me, it's such an honor to help facilitate these conversations. For anybody who knows me, I love one-on-one conversations. I love getting to know people and especially in this context, and sharing and spreading the word of recovery. It's quite an honor. And I know that this is putting folks in a place of vulnerability to come on and share the story to a wider audience like this. So tons of appreciation for all of the participants in this podcast up until now and coming up in the year to come. So today we have another member of our recovery campaign. Every year we highlight individuals in our community that have seen success in their recovery, people from all walks of life and who have found recovery through different means, and we always like to highlight that. We have their face on buses and on our social media platforms, and always with a really inspirational quote that means a lot to them and what recovery means to them. So It's an absolute pleasure to be able to dive in a little bit deeper and have these individuals on our podcast and hear their story. So Kevin was gracious enough to come on to the program and speak to me about his story. And it always blows me away the amount of adversity some folks need to overcome to achieve recovery. And absolutely exceptionally brave individual with a really unique story. So without further ado, welcome, Kevin. Okay, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today. And also, thank you for being part of our recovery campaign this year. It was kind of cool seeing your face. Did you ever see your face on a bus? I heard you were a little bit elusive.
I actually didn't see my face on a bus.
Okay.
I've had a couple friends send me images. And
perfect.
That made me excited to see that.
Yeah, no, that was really awesome. And yeah, like I said, this is a campaign that we've done the last couple of years just to try to, really put a story behind recovery and to just really get the word out there, and share these recovery stories. And that's the whole purpose behind this podcast as well. So I appreciate you taking the time to come and tell your story. It's really nice for me because we just met 10 minutes ago. And I think I said this to Daryl that I had on last week, that a lot of folks that I bring on, I already know their story and I already have a bit of a relationship with. And I actually get more excited hearing, stories and talking to people who I haven't met before. So it's a new experience for me too. So thanks for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy right now with school and everything, but
thanks for having me here.
Yeah, right on. So listen, I always like to start by diving back a little bit and, talking about where addiction first kind of started showing its face in your life and where your story starts, I guess. It's always up to you on how far you dive back, but can you kind of pinpoint a time where, addiction really started showing its face in your life, either by those around you or yourself?
Yeah. From what I can remember when I was younger, growing up as a kid, I would see my parents a lot, partying a lot, and I thought that was just like a normal thing. I think there was a couple of traumatic experiences where I'd woken up in the middle of the night and seen my mom being carried away on a stretcher because she may have OD'd, or not sure exactly what happened, but it's not something a kid should be seeing.
Yeah, right.
I guess my addiction started around the age of 10. I think I was in grade 6 and I got into a crowd that liked to smash windows on the building and cause disturbances, and I got a adrenaline rush out of that, and I wasn't taught how to deal with emotions properly when I was younger, so I had a lot of anger back then. And then I realized that if I started smoking and feeding that nicotine addiction, that it would calm me down. So I started smoking when I was 10.
Wow. Okay. Kind of like the self-medication almost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mind's going blank.
Oh, that's okay.
I guess one night around the same age, 10, 11, my dad had passed out and he left a full bottle of gin. I do not like gin, but I've seen how funny he gets sometimes if he overdoes it. So I figured, hey, why not give it a try? And I ended up drinking the whole bottle. It was a 2.6.
Your first?
Yes.
It was experience.
750 milliliter bottle.
Oh, wow.
I was intoxicated. I had a blast. But the next day, my first hangover, it was bad. I guess my dad obviously figured out that somebody in the house drank the whole bottle, and instead of disciplining me about it, he made me go with the family for a whole day walk along the beach, and I suffered the consequences all day. I just wanted to go home and lay down. So, yeah. I tried to get my hands on booze anytime I could, not severely that much. And I think I remember myself and friends and my siblings going down to the bar and asking random strangers to boot for us because we were way too young to be drinking. And eventually we would find somebody and they would do it. And we'd be going to party, and some of that chaos with the adrenaline rush got even crazier, where we were breaking into cars or beanies, and I have been through the courts for all that stuff, so I don't feel threatened. Like if I'm, what's that called when you incriminate yourself? I don't feel like I'm going to be doing that.
Sure, sure. This is So this is in your early teens then, that you're, so it's a pretty early start.
I've had a couple of friends pass away around that age. I should note, before the age of 10, I was being sexually abused. I went to my sister about that, and instead of contacting somebody outside the family, she just kind of stepped in face to face with the person, being like, don't do that, blah, blah, blah. It's haunted me ever since. Still does today. I'll get back to that later in the story, though.
Sure.
Trying to figure out, where are we? In my teens.
Right.
Despite all the illegal activities that I got into for fun with friends, luckily, I had this magic horseshoe up my ass, because I never actually went to jail, but I got so close so many times.
Just kind of flirting with it and just,
I think the last real thing a friend and I did was steal a truck, and we were just too tired to go home, too tired to walk home. So we're like, let's just steal a car and drive, and we'll leave it a few blocks away. But obviously, like, if that was to show up in the newspaper, my friend's grandparent, who we were going to stay at, would have known it was us. We were kind of known to the police. We ended up going up to Jordan River. We were on our way to Port Renfrew. We flew around the corner just past that that little store. Fishtailed it a bunch, lost control of the vehicle. We went down the embankment, rolled it I don't know how many times. He didn't have a seatbelt on. My head smashed out the side window. I had blood and glass in my face. We called for somebody to come pick us up and made some BS story and left it at that for a month. And that was slowly catching up to us. I had to go into the police station to talk to them about something else, and one cop walks by and says, "Mr. Turton, I've been looking for you about a stolen truck." And I'm like, "Well, you want to go talk in the back?" And then I admitted to everything. And okay. I went through the court, went on probation, had curfew.
How old were you at this point?
Around 18 or 20.
Okay. Right, so enough so that, yeah, this is not going to be a slap on the wrist if, yeah, right. Starting to become an adult matter and get a little bit more serious, yeah.
Yeah, right. So for as long as I could remember, I was roofing at the time. I'd be going to work, coming home, drinking, watching the same shows, doing the exact same thing every day, and it was boring. I guess the withdrawals were different every time, but there was ones where I was like almost seizuring on the floor. And
right. Were you trying it all? Was this kind of just like a daily process, or were you, you know, trying to have some bouts of sobriety in, intermixed in that, or was it pretty much just full on?
Full on.
Yeah, in the pattern.
I took off for the summer a couple of times to Port Renfrew to do work and made a lot of money, but by the time I got back, I was broke because I drank it all.
Right.
I got fired at the end of the, say, the last week or two of my season shift because I was drinking and missing work. And I got tired of that. I don't know, maybe around 2014, I phoned into a treatment center or the detox in Victoria. I wasn't sure who to talk to. They said I had to be sober. You know what? I don't remember exactly what they said there, but.
Right. Well, I think this is one of the hard parts that people don't realize is, yeah, when you're, you know, in active addiction and, you know, you're using substances to try to navigate these waters and remember and retain the information that's given to you. That's tough, right?
Yeah.
Try to do it on your own. Yeah. So this is the first real
advice he had given me. I basically like blew it off.
Right.
Ignored it. There's like a huge blank spot in my memory there.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just speed around towards 2015 when I first came into detox for real.
Okay. So this was right. You, there've been some times where you had made an effort, but never came to fruition. Never actually.
Yeah. My dad, Tom, he actually had 17 years of sobriety at one point.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I remember going to meetings with him when we lived in Vancouver. But then I don't know if I was actually living with him or just visiting, because a majority of my life, my biological dad wasn't there. My mom was there up until, well, around the age of 10 when we moved to Souk, to Vancouver Island, 1998, I believe. We did go through foster care for a year.
Right, man.
I just kept running away, and they kept putting me in new ones. Yeah, so I'd been binging for like a week or something straight in 2015, and I wanted to die. Because, well, I always had like suicidal thoughts. I never really acted on them. But I remember, I guess, that the guy who I spoke to previously from detox, or whoever I talked to, had said that there was a whole process and a waiting list.
Right.
So I didn't want to go through that. And I was like, well, I mean, I've been to the psych ward once. I woke up out of a blackout and I had two cops pointing their handguns at me.
Oh my God.
And I had a knife in my hand, and I guess I had been rubbing against my neck because I had cuts on my neck.
Holy.
And I was like, what's going on?
Right.
I'm like, why am I not wearing a shirt? I almost made a run for it to the bedroom just to grab a shirt because I knew somebody's going to give me somebody else's shirt.
Right.
That happened. I went to the hospital wearing somebody else's small shirt.
Oh, my God.
Looked stupid. But thankfully, I did not make that run because the cops were like, we were seriously about to pull the triggers.
Right.
So remembering being in the psych ward and talking to a doctor, that doctor had asked me if I wanted to go to detox, and I said no, I was drunk, I was just being dumb.
Right.
You know how it is.
Yeah, you're in the moment and that's not.
And they let me go, and I was like, are you serious?
Right.
Like, I had cops
pointing
guns at me.
And now you're just going back.
Threatening to kill myself, and you just let me go.
Right.
I think that's
wild.
Pretty stupid.
Yep, and that happens too much, yeah.
So, thinking about all that, I figured the best way to get in a detox fast was do a suicide thing. So, I don't remember. I don't think I even took anything to, like, OD. I was just hella intoxicated.
Right.
And I think I was just telling my mom, like, I want to kill myself.
Yeah.
And she was visiting, so they didn't know what to do with me at first. They were going to get me in the car, and then I took off running down the street, and somehow I was able to be served 2 tall cans at the liquor store. And I chugged those back. I was found passed out in the ditch, and my family decided to bring me to the hospital, and through that, I ended up being in detox for 8 days.
Right, so they did a fast track to detox for
you?
Yeah,
they did.
Man.
The plan
worked. What a weird system we have where, you know, those are the means to actually get, you know, somewhat immediate care. That's yeah. But you got there, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And that was, and this is the first time being through a detox, or, you know, apart from some meetings and some attempts, this is your first real kick at the can.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, detox was hard without smoking.
Yeah.
I'm sure it is for a lot of
people. It's a big barrier. Yeah, absolutely.
Trying not to go crazy, just not being allowed outside or not even having a window to open.
Right.
Excuse me. So I went through those 8 days, got out. I ended up going back to Sioux to pick up a last paycheck, and then I came back to Victoria, and I ended up getting into stabilization, which was like 30 days.
Amazing.
I had to make an effort to prove that I wanted to go, so I was going to RAS every day, and they see my attendance there every day.
Yeah, for those who don't know, RAS is a drop-in group through Island Health that's 365 days a year, which is really nice, and yeah, a good way to prove your readiness for sure, because they do have you, yeah, so kind of you register every day when you go in, so yeah. Cool,
yeah.
So you're hitting RAS every day, which is great.
They give you a bus ticket and a pool pass.
Crystal pool, yeah, amazing, yeah. It's a great routine to get into.
Great incentive to go.
Yeah.
It took me a while before I actually had my first share. I came in, and I'm a tall guy, and then I have a great resting bitch face or poker face. So when I get vulnerable, I make myself look mean or whatever. It's
sure.
Like putting up my guards.
It's like a defense mechanism or something. Yeah.
It was really weird to have people being like, hey, can I give you a hug? And part of me was like, no. But part of me was like, you know, it's been a long time since I even got a hug from like my brothers or family. It felt like. So
right.
I was like, hell yeah. Give me
okay.
a hug.
Yeah.
I love that. I think it was 6 months in, I got a sponsor. And I started working the steps, and I started, well, I had shared a bit previously, but I started talking to people more, and I realized the more I started talking and people started getting to know me, that I actually started having friends, and we were doing fellowship outside of meetings.
Like, right.
We'd meet up at meetings, do the meetings, and then go for coffee or lunch. And
right. So you're starting to build a support network around
yeah.
you.
Yeah, and a lot of people who have been in there long enough are offering to pay for my lunches, because at that point I'm broke, I'm jobless.
Right.
It really meant a lot to me.
Right. So, and this is after your, you know, through your stabilization run and kind of out, and so you're kind of maintaining your sobriety at this point?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I'm like thinking, should I share this story? I think I was 5 months sober, and I had to go to Vancouver for what's supposed to be a funeral for my godfather, uncle. So I went out there. My mom came down to visit from, she lives in Prince George. She's always lived in Prince George. So I was there with my Auntie Jeannie, my mom, my cousin. They were intoxicated the whole time.
Oh, it's so difficult.
It was okay at first, but later in the evening, I was like on the phone. I had locked myself in the bathroom, and I phoned my sponsor, and I was like, I figured I had two options. My story is like kind of all over the place.
That's okay.
So at the time I went to visit Vancouver, I had just got into a recovery house. It was called the Human Exchange.
Okay.
Everybody thinks that's a weird name.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
I remember that.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
It's not open anymore.
Right.
But. Yeah, I told my sponsor I had two options, either grab their whole case of beer, lock myself in the bathroom and just drink it all, or get on the phone with my sponsor and phone him.
Right.
And I had my step book with me, and he was like kind of like proud. He was like and surprised that like I had phoned him and I had brought my step work with me.
Right.
He didn't expect me to bring that with me. And I just talked to him for a couple hours and calmed down. And my cousin at the time was highly egotistic and kind of like a workout monkey, kind of.
Sure.
Big arms, and he's always showing off.
Right.
How much his pants, his clothing costs and stuff. And
okay.
I'm like, I don't care.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I calmed down. The next day, I had gone for a walk with my auntie, and we were trying to find some address, and it took all day, and we did not find it. And then I had to walk her back, and she's been drinking all day, and she's like, let's cut through East Hastings. I'm like, let's not cut through East Hastings. But walking with her, she's short-legged. I'm like, it's going to take forever. We've been walking all day. Let's just cut through. I end up getting sucker punched by some big guy.
Oh, no.
Because I looked at him.
Oh, my God.
So then we get back to the apartment, and I'm in a bit of pain still. A little bit of blood came out of my ear. I asked my auntie if I could just go lay down in her bed, because they weren't going to go to bed anyways, right? So I was laying in bed trying to sleep, and I was getting itchy, and I figured, because it's the summertime, there's mosquitoes going on, right? So I covered my head under the blanket. Hours later, I'm still itchy, and I'm like, oh, my God, I hope there's no bed bugs in here. The bed had bed bugs in there.
Oh, no.
Worst trip ever.
Yeah.
No funeral ever happened.
What?
I ended up leaving earlier than I was supposed to, because I was like,
you had to get out of there.
You guys are dangerous to me right now.
Yeah.
So
Like a multiple triggers, right? Yeah. And you stayed sober throughout that?
I did.
Wow.
When I got back to the recovery house, I was talking to the facilitator, and I was like, do you want to drug test me? Come on, drug test me.
Right. You're proud of yourself. Yeah.
He's like, dude, I've never met anybody who wanted to be drug tested so bad. And he's like, I trust you. And he never drug tested me.
Okay.
I was like, that's cool.
That's a pretty good sign, you know, someone asking for it, that, yeah, you obviously had confidence and, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like you did the right things, right? Calling your sponsor. That's a hard call to make when you're kind of, yeah, facing that. That's a, yeah, when you have these two options right in front of you. It's cool to, gives you confidence when you choose the right one.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, and just, I remember the Groundhog Days, everything being the same, and I didn't want to go back that way.
Right.
Thinking, so I ended up doing like all the suggestions at the meetings, go to a meeting a day for 90 days.
Okay.
Do the sponsor, do the steps.
You were saying yes. Yeah. You're right.
I ended up, secretarying the meetings, and then I ended up chairing the meetings, and then I was like, you know what, this is easier than chairing, and I kind of stopped chairing for a while.
Okay.
And I just did the chairing service, and but I felt this ego building up in myself, and
right.
I stopped looking at everybody as if we were equals, and then I was like, I got more clean time than you, so I'm better.
How far along were we at this point?
In my 4 years.
Like how far in within, like,
this is, so I'm talking about my first 4 years.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm in a second set of 4 years now.
Sure, okay. So you're in your, so you're getting good recovery time, but you feel like, which is so common, that the ego and the kind of overconfidence kind of starts taking over a little bit.
Yeah, and I liked it because I had confidence. I hardly ever have that. So I ended up not taking my 4 year cake, and sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah, I don't know. After work one day, I just decided to get a few drinks, and it was fun. Nothing happened after two tall cans.
Right.
I did wake up hungover, and I was like surprised off of two beers.
Right.
And then I kind of pre-planned that I would have a drink once a month.
Oh, so started opening the door. Yeah.
Yeah, but it didn't take long to be drinking every weekend.
Right.
To having my roommate disappointed in me at the time when she lived with me. I'd go hang out, I'd say on the res, but it's more like where Blanchard Courts is. It's not called Blanchard Courts anymore. It's called something else.
Right.
But back when there's a lot, well, I guess they're still partying there. I just don't go down there no more.
Right.
But I found my fit. I found myself hanging out with people that beat somebody up at the party, and then hours later I was at some address with some people about to kick somebody's door, and I was like, what the hell am I doing?
Where did it, right.
How did this come into my life again?
Right.
So I ended up going home. I stopped hanging out with those people. What'd I do? I still use, though. I still stayed out there in addiction for a whole year.
Okay. So you're trying to cut those ties, but the addiction is now gotten a hold again.
Yeah, I was blaming COVID for not going to work, but I happened to be hungover at the same time.
Right. So this is right around COVID, which is, man, wreaked havoc on people in recovery, right? It just gave excuses, right? Yeah, to kind of not do the work. And yeah.
I ended up getting an ultimatum from my boss, either come to work tomorrow or don't come in at all.
Okay.
And it was around the beginning of COVID where everybody was freaked out on being on a public bus with crowds, and I didn't think a mask was going to save me. So,
right.
I mean, I can kind of blame that, but honestly, it was because I just wanted to continue drinking. So,
right.
I got fired. I've been through so many jobs in my life. Majority of them are more because I think I end up getting bored, and I just want to do something else.
Right.
But there's a good variety in there where I was fired because of my addiction.
Yep. And these are all in trades, I'm assuming. You said you were a roofer and,
yeah, majority of them.
Majority of trades, yeah. Where there's a little bit more acceptance around substances. And we know substances are kind of rampant in the trades, yeah.
But, yeah.
Right.
I guess I forgot to mention that I have a heart condition.
Okay.
It's called atrial fibrillation. It's basically like your heart is struggling to beat. So it can skip beats and add beats, but it's not normal. It makes you feel really tired all the time. I don't have it right now.
Okay.
But the point of me bringing this up is because my youngest brother had it. He'd been to the hospital for many tests, gone through everything. He went through some kind of procedure. Right around a month or two before I finally got sober again, he decided to go off his meds. He was 24. You know how younger guys
right.
think they're invincible, can
yeah.
live forever. Well, he ended up dying.
Holy shit.
And I was still in active addiction, as I said. I had to make that phone call to the family from after talking with the police.
Wow.
And that was rough. They weren't, like, obviously really long phone calls, because as soon as I said Esmond passed away, they
right.
just started screaming and bawling
yeah.
their eyes out. And, my family ended up resenting me because I didn't go visit them throughout this whole process because
okay.
I was still in active addiction. I didn't want them to see me like that
right.
because I know, I guess it annoys them, but I don't want to be going through withdrawals and being stuck in Souk when I live in Victoria. So
right.
I was selfish in that part.
And the guilt and shame too. It can be a pretty nasty beast, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So a month or two after, I played the suicide card again to try and get a detox real quick. This time I actually took a concoction, but I mean, if somebody really wants to end themselves, they wouldn't announce it to people.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that.
Right.
The cops were actually in my living room when I drank the stuff in front of them. It's
right.
like, now you have to take me to the hospital.
Gotcha. Okay.
I threw all of it up in the ambulance. I was in the hospital for maybe 18 hours, and they said it looks like it's going to be like a week, maybe two, maybe longer before you get a detox. And I'm like, they were giving me a Valium here and there to like calm my nerves. But I was like, if I actually am going to die, which I probably wouldn't, but that's just how I felt because I was so
yeah.
hungover.
Right.
I was used to drinking big bottles every day.
Right.
Of vodka. Ugh. I don't even like vodka. So, yeah, I said, if I'm going to die, I'm going to go home and just lay down on the couch and watch TV and stuff. So that's what I did. And I suffered for probably 12 days straight with you could say, like, I don't know, a week it felt like I was going through withdrawals, but 12 days with the anxiety afterwards lingering.
Right.
And even then, a friend had reached out, hey, do you want to go to a meeting? I'm like, no, man, I feel like crap. I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
I don't remember when I started going back to meetings, but I did for a little bit. Remembering back in my high egotistic days into the relapse, I was sleeping around a lot. That became an addiction.
Right.
So this time around in addiction, I was like, I can't really go to meetings. There's lots of attractive women at meetings, I'm not going to lie. And I can't get my thoughts past being like, I don't know how to say that without sounding creepy. So I'm not going to say that.
Right.
But
there's you'd create a barrier.
There's an
kind
attraction
of
there for sure.
Yeah, right.
So I stopped going to meetings. I haven't really done too many of the suggestions. I didn't do the 90-90. I haven't done another set of steps since the first time. I still have a sponsor. Even though I haven't like done a written set of steps, I remember certain things in the book, and I like to follow them whenever I get into like a conflict argument with somebody.
Sure.
Sometimes, depending on how mad I get, it might take 24 hours before I reach in and be like, I apologize for my part. I don't even bring up their part, because that's what you do with the steps,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. You take your ownership of your actions, yeah.
For sure.
So when you kind of got, you know, entered into sobriety the second time, that was just you on your own, or did you end up getting to detox after the gap? Or
no, I didn't.
So it was, you just went for it.
I think I went 20 days, and then the detox finally called me back, and I said, I kind of want to go in there, but because I was sober, they said no.
Oh, my God.
Hung up, basically.
Right. Yeah.
It was okay, though.
You were already kind of, obviously, so you just decided to ride it out, and it seemed to be working in a certain degree. You're doing things a little differently this time, but at the same time, still kind of had that foundation from before.
Yeah, I have sort of used playing video games as a, what would you call it? Trading one addiction for another kind of thing.
Sure.
And I thought it was a healthier way to be than drinking or using drugs.
Yeah.
I think I just kind of took it easy. I went and did different jobs with friends in the past I've worked with, painting. Went to the odd meeting. I played a lot of video games, but then I was kind of getting bored again. Mm-hmm. And then my friend Amber, she's doing upgrading math and English, and she's like, what did you graduate? And I was like, yeah, I graduated with grade 11 math and English. And she's like, well, if you're bored, you can come do this. We could go to class together. It'd be fun. And I was like, yeah, why not? So I started doing the upgrading. She ended up getting pregnant. I don't know, about halfway through or so. So she ended up leaving. It was kind of sad to see her go, but I continued to keep going.
Okay.
And I've never really known what I want to do for a career. I don't know if I've ever really found that passion where I know I could stay somewhere
right.
for longer than like 6 months.
Right, sure, yeah.
I ended up finding a job, part-time job. So my upgrading was at the Native Friendship Center in Victoria,
okay.
Through Camosun, and one of my friends, Herb, was, I don't know if he still works there now, but he was working at the Friendship Center, janitor service, and he's like, it's easy work, you can probably do this and do your upgrading. And I was
okay.
like, well, I mean, I'm on disability, you only get so much. So I said, sure, why not? I can do that
right.
part time and make some extra cash, whatever.
Yeah.
And I felt weird at first considering myself in the custodial world, because I'd always looked down on people like that. but I mean, that's the way I grew up. So it was nice to actually be there. The job was pretty simple. It was a lot, but that really widened my eyes to becoming more humble about that kind of work. And I ended up being a maintenance guy too after I told them, I know how to use the power tools. I know how to do this. If there's something I don't know how to do, I will tell you.
Right. But otherwise, show my way. Yeah.
Reason, right? In my first week, the boss, my manager, wanted me to get a raise because she liked my work ethic. I was just taught like that.
Right.
Because in between doing loads of laundry for the shelter, I had to be doing something. I couldn't just sit there. So I end up cleaning things that probably hadn't been cleaned in a while.
Right.
Because it's not on a regular chore list, say.
Right.
So I ended up finishing my upgrading. I finished the English all the way up to the grade 12 level. The math, I ended up dropping at the last textbook. Okay. Because I was like, this is crazy. It's crazy.
It does
hard.
Get pretty wild towards the end of the day. Yeah.
I'm like, I don't see myself
not the most applicable. Yeah.
Doing any kind of job where I specifically need that. So
sure.
I dropped it.
Yeah.
But then I was like, I kind of planned with some teacher assistant about what I was doing afterwards. And I was like, just spontaneously, I was like, well, why don't I take Indigenous studies? And I thought that was maybe a couple month program, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I had never looked into the criteria about it. So when I was setting up for it, I realized it was like a 2-year program.
Right.
And that scared me.
Sure.
That's a long commitment.
Yeah.
Just I've never been to college before. Knowing that I'm possibly going to be in a classroom with people around my age, maybe a bit older, definitely younger people, just fresh out of high school kind of deal. And
and
that is the case. I was anxious about it, but I pushed myself through it, and I'm going into like 7 weeks today.
Wow. Good for you.
It is overwhelming. About once a week, I want to drop all the classes.
But sure.
I push through those mood swings.
Yeah. That's obviously a pretty big, step in the right direction. And kind of getting some momentum going and opening up possibilities for you. And you're still working at the Friendship Center then?
No, I ended up putting my 2 weeks in.
Okay. To really focus on the school.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Prior to working there, I was working at a restaurant, Bard and Banker, and then another place called Tapestry.
Okay.
Both cooking. And doing that with the upgrading, it was too much.
Sure.
So I ended up having to end those. So I don't know. I don't know how I knew. I just assumed that it was going to be harder here. It is all pretty basic, but like trying to think about different kinds of frameworks and analyzing one page in a book can be overthought way too easily.
Right.
And
so it's learning how to learn again. And it's a completely different skill set, isn't it?
Yeah. There's times where I feel unintellectual among the younger people that just got out of high school or maybe they got out of high school a year before or whatever. But I graduated 2007. So that's a long time since I've been in school.
Right. Yeah.
So I have people reminding me, like, just don't be hard on yourself.
Yeah.
You gotta retrain your brain.
Totally. I think it takes a lot of courage to try, but it, obviously it sounds overwhelming, but doesn't sound overly boring at this point. It sounds like it's keeping you engaged, and
it does. Yeah, I'm happy that I go. It kind of gives me, what's that word? I can't really say accomplished because I'm only at the beginning of the program, but like, I just feel good that I'm doing something during the day. I'm not playing video games because back even just after the upgrading, I was thinking like, okay, what am I going to do after? I can play 1,000 hours in a video game and have all those objectives in there completed, but I haven't really done anything with my life. I go to work part-time or under the table.
Yeah.
And I haven't gained anything but money and paying my rent.
Right. So there was kind of a little bit of stasis going on, so you didn't feel like you're making progress.
Yeah.
And now you've got progress in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty empowering feeling. Yeah.
And then having my face on a bus or, or the billboard thing.
Right. Well, and like I said, and that's, you know, and so you're kind of at the 4-year mark now, again, after, you know, so that's in the last decade, that's a lot of sober time that you have under your belt. That's quite remarkable.
Yeah, I didn't, I have to admit that I have not celebrated my 4-year cake, and it was in September.
Okay. Well, you know, and I think everybody's different with how to celebrate. And some people are like, you know what, it's just another day, and this is all a process of moving forward. But hey, that's, you know, that's a really substantial amount of time, and yeah, something to feel proud of. And it's cool too that you see that progress now too, and that you're, you know, building and starting to you know, start new chapters in your life, which is really cool, because I think that's a lot of what addiction can do, is keep us in a certain place for so long, right? So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so remember at the beginning I talked about a little bit about the sexual abuse?
Yeah.
I said I was going to bring it back up again?
Yeah.
Well, that person passed away about a year ago. But before he passed away, like literally hours, and he was not talking, but when you talk to him, you could see that he could hear you. He just, for some reason, couldn't wake up. He couldn't be conscious.
Right.
I had spoken to his ear, I forgive you.
Wow.
I believe that it was real this time when I said it, because I've said it a couple of times, trying to make myself believe it. Just to get through my steps, really.
Yeah.
But
you weren't there.
Yeah. Yet. So yeah. I believe that you can only move forward if you actually let go of the past. And
yeah. Wow.
So I can still be traumatized if those images randomly pop up in my mind, what happened to me. But it's easier to deal with these days, and they pop up a hell of a lot less frequently than they did before.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that yeah, obviously, you know, some closure, at least on your part, to be able to have had that opportunity. And yeah, that takes a lot too. That's a pretty unbelievable, you know, feat unto itself to be able to forgive, you know, I think.
Mm.
Yeah. Huh.
So I have another brother and a sister out there, unfortunately, doing their own thing with their addictions.
Right.
I've had to put up boundaries against my brother because I can't take the lying anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, anything that comes out of his mouth is truthful or not, and he has done some things after the person passed away that I had said that I had forgiven him about his actions. But I think I tend to do a lot of action before thinking.
Sure.
And these last couple of months, I've really realized that I still resent him for some of his actions.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess eventually I'm going to get a hold of him and be like, do you want to go meet for a coffee and actually try to talk? Because, I mean, it's hard. The way my family and I grew up, we never sat in front of each other and talked about our issues. It'd either be fist fighting or talking shit behind your back.
Right. So it's destructive, not productive.
I never liked that kind of communication that we lacked in our family.
Right.
And it still shows on his side where I try to tell him exactly what he has done that's pissed me off or whatever. And I try to be as respectful as I can, but no matter how I say it, he ends up just not speaking to me for months. He told me to have a nice life and he was done with me. And then he goes to mom and says that, I got no family down here. And I'm like, you do have family, but you got to change your you got to change your behaviors.
I think that's really hard to set these boundaries.
And he's an adult, so why should I be stepping in? It's really hard because I'm his brother.
Right. And I think that that's always the hardest part is, you know, talk about setting boundaries and also holding people accountable and but not taking on the way they react to that, right? You know, and knowing that, hey, if I'm going to be truthful and honest in this relationship, I got to, you know, set these things out. And how someone responds to that isn't our responsibility, but that's hard to do when it's close and it's family.
Hypocritical.
Yeah, sure.
Because I have kind of like ignored some friends, maybe some friends in recovery, they might be using weed to help for pain or something, and I just brush it off. But then my brother, he still smokes weed and drinks, but he doesn't do his main DLC. And then he keeps telling me he has 13 months clean, but I'm like, dude, it was less than 13 months I saw you, and you were fucked up on something.
Right.
Yes, because for me, I was taught it's all drugs.
Right.
So you don't really necessarily talk about your clean date for this drug and then this drug. It's whichever drug you used last.
Right.
But I did tell him I was proud of him for not using his main drug.
There you go. Yeah.
And then I said, that's all you can do. Stop telling me that you have 13 months. Right. This is bullshit. Right. And then he got pissed.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's hard sometimes having real conversations. But I mean, so, you know, somebody who's seen success in recovery, I always like to ask, you know, if you meet someone who's just, you know, wanting to get sober or is just kind of starting their journey, what advice or suggestions would you give? Do you have, you know, any words of wisdom?
I didn't think about that. You just take it one day at a time. Sometimes that one day, you have to break it up into hours or even minutes. Sometimes it's a long process. You might hear in meetings that it gets better. Don't assume that it's going to get better within a month or two.
Right. Absolutely.
Think about it as if you had a broken bone. Your addiction is that. No, sorry. Your newfound recovery is that broken bone.
Right.
It will heal in time. But you'll still always have like that scar, that reminder. I forgot the last part of that.
No, that was amazing, man. I love that. And I love, you know, talking about that. Mm-hmm. Everyone does always say one day at a time, but sometimes it's gotta be 1 hour at a time, right? You know, and mm-hmm. kind of piecemealing sometimes. And I love that, you know, you're saying too, it is a long process. I think some of the time, you know, a lot of times when we get it wrong, it's when people think that they're further along in their recovery than they are, or they want to be further along and not recognizing this is a long way to go. I love that analogy about the broken bone. Yeah. It takes time. Yeah.
Yeah. If you can be in a position where you don't have to go to work, you can get some kind of supplements. I recommend doing that. Staying away from work as long as possible. Staying away from relationships is probably the best advice. But, I mean, some people break it. And I'd say a huge majority of them end up breaking up. And some people end up relapsing. But I have seen couples stay together throughout
the whole
process.
Right.
It's risky though. Like,
yeah, I feel you. I've seen more people go out because of relationships or work. You're totally right. And it's kind of like this, like fast tracking, like making up for lost time almost. Like, okay, now I'm sober, I gotta, you know, put my life back together really fast instead of, yeah, you know, like you say, waiting it out and giving it the time it deserves to kind of settle and take root. Yeah.
Yeah. I've told people that even after you are long dead, hopefully from old age, that work is still going to be there. So there's no rush to just hop back on the horse and start working your ass off and stressing out.
Right. Yeah.
Especially when you're like in your first year, even it's tough. You need to take it. You need to practice patience and do a lot of self-care. I remember telling myself in the mirror that I would say my whole name. I would say you're a beautiful human being, some other things, and I would laugh for the first couple of days doing that.
Right.
But after a while, I was like, I like this.
Right.
And I'm actually believing it now too, that I do love myself.
Right. Yeah, it takes time. Yeah, it takes time to get there. That's right. Those practices, they feel a little bit weird at first, right? Yeah. That's amazing. Listen, I think you touched on a few things that I'm really glad you did. I don't know if anyone has before, you know, and recognizing, yeah, this is a long process. You seem to have found rhythm and you seem to be kind of building momentum in your kind of personal journey. So that's great. And like I said, it's cool that, yeah, you are, you know, the face of recovery, at least in this small town. And, you know, I love that. I think you have, you know, a really powerful story. Looks like there was some real, you know, big challenges to overcome in your journey. And it looks like you're well on the way of doing that. So, yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and yeah, share your story. This really resonates for sure.
Cool.
All right. Yeah. No, thanks so much. Thank you so much to Kevin for sharing such a powerful story, and just being so vulnerable, you know, to be so open in sharing your story. So, you know, this really struck a chord with me, and I know it's going to strike a chord with a lot of folks who are listening. Something that really, you know, struck me and always blows me away is, you know, Kevin having to go to extreme measures, you know, talking about suicide and suicide attempts in order to access real-time detox supports. This is, you know, for me, unacceptable in our community. And it's something that has been an issue since we started. Whenever anyone asks me what needs to change, I always talk about a more robust detox service. It's a no-brainer for me. Somebody should be able to access real-time detox supports multiple times, regardless of the substance they use. So right now, our wait times in our community are substantial, 4 to 6 weeks to access a 7-day, you know, medical detox program. And a lot of times folks are turned away based on priority. So, you know, if they're using stimulants, they're not going to be accepted into our detox program. I think this is just, such a miss. And what we do find is individuals will access the emergency department in order to get access to detox services and to medically get detoxed. So, you know, we have such an overrun, emergency room. It's something that's, you know, quite an issue. And the amount of people that are substance use affected that are coming into the hospitals are huge. We could really mitigate that by having a better detox program, you know, that can admit people and really work on identifying the care that they need. But this is also a point, too, where people are coming in. If they're detoxing from a substance, this is a great time to get connected with resources and supports and maybe look at extending their recovery time, right? So this is a prime time to catch people where they have a little bit of momentum and a little bit of motivation to make those changes. So, you know, for me, investing in better, more robust detox services is just like a no-brainer, and it will end up saving taxpayers money in the long run. So I will get on my soapbox anytime I can and talk about the need for better detox services. There's obviously tons of changes that need to happen, but that one for me is just, it is so crucial. And the need to have better staffing, and more diverse supports, and just more access to detox services, man, that would go such a long way. So there you go. There's my spiel for the day. This is conversation that we'll continue to have. I'm really excited to keep these podcasts going. I will have another one out in 2 weeks' time, and these will keep running through the fall. So please keep listening. Please keep spreading the word of recovery. Hopefully people can listen and get inspired. There's always hope. Recovery is possible for everyone. So let's just keep on spreading the good word. See you in a couple weeks. My name is Blake Anderson.